You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Hi, this is Marcus Lutyens, and today on this show, we're talking to Brainerd Carey. Thank you for being with us.
It's exciting to talk to you. It's nice to be on the other end.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So I guess to begin, some questions. The first question would be, you know, how does it feel to be interviewed instead of being the interviewer?
I like it. I mean, it makes me slightly apprehensive, which gives me a nice insight into what everyone's been telling me they feel. But it's also, you know, if I can compare it to kind of like an early art project of Praxis, which is, you know, what I'm the co-founder of, is it's kind of like giving out hugs, right? I was giving out hugs for a while. It's not that I wasn't getting hugs, but it's different than if I went to someone like Amma and received a hug. It's still an exchange. A conversation is like a hug, but it's I suppose, a little different when, depending on who's initiating it.
Well, perhaps I'm giving you a hug also on behalf of all the other people that you've interviewed in the past and will in the future.
Thank you.
I guess another question would be, you know, what are your aims, your general aims of putting together this body of interviews? Is it, you know, more about documentation of the art world, or would you say there's a kind of underlying art form in the process here?
I think, you know, when people ask me if this is a project itself, if this is like an artistic project of some kind, you know, initially my answer is no. You know, it's that's not how it was conceived or started, and I don't really have kind of an end game or a plan. It's not that books will come out of this, although I'm sure books will come out of it, but it's really more about an interest in conversation, period, which is how I started this process. I wanted to talk to certain people, meet people that I admired, and the interview process, which, you know, I began quite a while ago with writing for the Brooklyn Rail, I found very exciting. So there isn't really, is it an artist project? I guess you could say yes, it is, you know, especially since I already made the comparison to like early Praxis projects of hugs and foot washings. It is an intimate exchange, and it is this, you know, this kind of social project, but ultimately those weren't really my goals. It's one of the few things that doesn't have any specific value that I'm reaching for. You know, it's a project that I love because it's almost like, you know, going to fly kites or something, or going for walks. It's not as though I'm going to then incorporate that in my artistic practice, though I can't exclude it from my artistic practice if that's seen in the broadest sense. But it wasn't intended that way. It's simply one of the most enjoyable things that I can think of, and it's become more so as I continue to talk to people.
That's fantastic. Well, I suppose, I mean, apart from Praxis, there's also this Museum of Non-Visible Art that you've been involved in spawning. And, you know, I suppose this kind of radio process would be in the realm of the non-visible. So, you know, having said that it's like flying a kite and just enjoyable for the sake of it, would you see this being integrated perhaps into that museum?
Yeah, it is. And I know flying a kite sounds a little glib. I take this process enormously seriously. I realize that it is an important archive. People from the Smithsonian to others have reached out to me and told me the importance of the archive. So I'm definitely aware of that. It's just that unlike kind of a job, which isn't really, or not in the strict sense of, you know, me getting paid for doing interviews by Yale. It's nothing like that. It's student radio. But I think that it's to discuss the non-visible museum, which I will, it's in a way it is attached to it and it has become, in a sense, a project of the non-visible museum, partly because almost by accident, the URL that I have for all the files that I upload to the internet is museumofnonvisibleart.com. So though I could adjust it, by default, all the radio programs are linked to that URL, though maybe some people see it, some people don't. it's almost not there. But the fact that that is occurring and that wasn't initially intentional by me makes it seem more and more all the time, especially as these are getting more popular, that, you know, begs the question, what is the Museum of Non-Visible Art? So in that sense, yeah, I think if I'm answering your question, that indirect way, it is part of it, yeah.
It also seems that as over time, you know, with the kind of electronic media, things are getting less and less tangible in any case. And, you know, perhaps, you know, physical museums will stop existing in some way, perhaps, and become non-visible and also not have a place, perhaps. I don't know if that's a possible kind of avenue for the Museum of the Non-Visible.
Well, it is, you know, I mean, that's art making as we know it might stop. If we're going to reach for, you know, like museums may cease to exist the way we know it, art making might cease to exist the way we know it. And, you know, I'm not proposing that, but the Museum of Non-Visible Art is built on this idea that you can, initially it started with, you know, my wife and I, who are the collaborative praxis, creating these works of art that are, you know, referencing other things like Yoko Ono or Kossuth, but in a slightly lighter manner, you know, in a slightly more playful manner, and also something that's not so much about, as the work has been in the past, about artist as the person who's the author of everything, but creating spaces so that others can be the author of it. And you know, in brief, what the Non-Visible Museum is it houses or points to housing works that exist only as kind of title cards. And, you know, you go into a museum, you see a big painting on the wall or whatever it is, a sculpture on the floor, and there's a little title card on the wall that's, you know, about 4 by 5 inches and has the artist's name, date, and explain something about it. In Museum of Non-Visible Art, or MONA as I call it, it's really about process, I think, of pointing to something that's not there. So people look at the card, there's no artwork there, and they have to imagine what it is, see it in their mind's eye. So, I mean, to begin with, it's the reason it was set up as a museum, because that's one thing, right? This is art that you can't, you know, physically buy, that you do buy the card and you do buy authentication papers that go with it. But the idea of the museum was because we wanted it to function as a museum. And really, David Ross, who is a good friend and began buying this work from us, he's the former director of the Whitney and SF MoMA, began encouraging both of us to pursue it exactly the way a museum is founded and built. So, but obviously a new model. So while the artworks were sold through Kickstarter with the notion of we're trying to establish a museum, the idea of the museum was it would have twofold. It would be a curatorial process, and it would also be so there would be artwork shown, but then there'd be an educational wing, like most museums, which is where there's workshops. So, for example, like in the Slovenian Biennial a few years ago, we went there and explained to a group of children as well as, you know, adults what non-visible art is, and then we do a workshop. We'd say, okay, everybody write down a painting, you know, just describe a painting. And then they describe it and read it. So they're making art. And to me, it's a way for, I mean, imagine kids doing this in elementary school. They can take, you know, clay or drawing or, you know, something else. Or they can make non-visible art. It's a way of introducing, I think, a kind of conceptual thinking into young minds,
yeah,
without it being too taxing or difficult. It's a way to get them involved in that notion. I don't know if I'm being too long-winded here, but
certainly. I think that there is a kind of tendency in certain art fields to, you know, kind of kind of dissolution of authorship and dissolution of the work itself. I mean, certainly in my own work with hypnosis, like, I kind of see a lot of rapport there. So very attractive.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, that's why it's interesting that you're interviewing me, because yeah, I also see a rapport in your work.
And also what I mentioned in my interview was, it's interesting also to turn the spotlight from the artist or you know, the person being interviewed, the so-called important person, to back, you know, towards the visitors, you know. So in that sense.
Absolutely. And what you were saying earlier about the idea of, you know, would museums be different, you know, or could they be different, or would this point to something, that's the current portion of this project, which is to build the museum. And so to build the museum, what you have to do is, and this is, again, something which is why I mentioned David Roth, the idea of that he was encouraging us and in a way mentoring us with, you know, do a call to architects. So we're in the process of doing a call to architects. They've already gotten some plans. But the idea is, so if you're doing a call to architects and the job is to develop a museum of non-visible art, and they understand enough what a museum of non-visible art is, which is these kind of empty walls, empty spaces, and cards that a docent could walk someone through, and just as they do with those cards on the wall, start riffing on them and talking about history. The question is, what does the museum look like? So the idea was, we get, you know, maybe there's five finalists who are come up with museum designs. And again, it's not like most architectural projects. The space could be anywhere. It could be physical, not physical, combination of the two, anything. There's just no rules in this. And so then let's say there are five finalists at a place like Performance Space 122 in New York who would support this and is already supporting it. Those architects would then present their plans and have to explain why this is the best design for MoNA, Museum of Non-Visible Art. And for us, that would be kind of like a mind-bending discussion. So you'd have a panel there of critical thinkers, writers, artists, museum directors, and they're asking the person questions who's doing this presentation to an audience. And it would stretch the idea of what is the museum of the future? What is the role of a museum? Do we need them, and in what form, and how do they become sort of almost infinitely malleable? So it isn't just we need walls to hang stuff kind of thing. So, I mean, just to answer that question about how does it actually affect the notion of museums in the future, that's the idea, yes, of the call to architecture.
Yeah, but I suppose also there's this kind of multidisciplinary nature that's really interesting, you know, working with art, you know, not just keeping it limited to artists, but within also your interviews, you know, you were interviewing arts professionals as well, and I suppose by extension, architects, and who knows where it may go from there as well. Do any interviews particularly stand out for you that you've done so far? Any exciting or strange or uncanny interviews that you remember?
Yes, many of them. Let's see. Exciting or strange or uncanny. I like all of those words very much, and I think that fits a lot of them. You know, it's what's interesting about the interviews is what I think will happen is never what will happen. There are people who I imagine, oh, we're going to talk about, like Donald Cuspid, you know, the great critic and writer. I think, oh, we're going to talk about, you know, critical thinking and something else. And then instead we ended up talking about his poems. He read his poems, three of them, and we talked about death and the difficulty of approaching that subject. So that was kind of wonderful in a way, because it was so unexpected. And, you know, and I'm probably going to mention some well-known people, but, you know, like Andre Serrano was also fascinating. You know, the artist that's so well-known for Piss Christ and everything else, not only was his apartment, you know, kind of like a monk's cell with all this 16th century sculpture and paintings on the wall. I mean, it was something really kind of extraordinary. You're in the, you know, in downtown New York, and, you know, he's got all the walls made to look like they're gigantic blocks of marble. It's just kind of incredible space. But more interesting was his relationship to Christianity, and that he's a practicing Christian and sees all his work as devotional, as religious art in the strict sense, you know, would like to work for the Pope. So, you know, completely sincere about that. And seems to me he's never read that way. He's read as someone who's creating blasphemous work or provocative work, and it's actually all about a kind of very deep spirituality. If you look at the homeless work he's done, the shit paintings, the shit photographs, and, you know, the bodily fluids, it's in a way could be said to be all about that. So I could mention more, but those are a few to come to mind. But yeah, a lot of them have been quite interesting. Princess Alia Al-Sanusi was quite interesting. You know, she's Middle Eastern princess, or coming from that kind of background, and and talked in a very elegant way about
I coincidentally I sat down next to her at dinner in England a few months ago. We had a good conversation too. I suppose one interesting thing is that this interview process is almost like weaving a web. You know, I suppose it's in a binary system of, you know, interviewer and interviewed, but ultimately these a kind of web of people who are a kind of zeitgeist of activity that's happening inside this art world. And it's interesting probably that there are all these kind of links, tangential links. You were talking about Lawrence Wiener earlier, and, you know, I was just exhibiting with him at the Istanbul Biennial, and there's some links there too, and I'm sure your experiences with him kind of reflected, you know, some of the stories that happened there as well, and so there's a kind of storytelling aspect of this whole process, which is interesting, I think.
There is, right. We were talking about Lawrence Wiener a little bit, I guess, off the record before the interview, and the talk with him was interesting. I went to his studio and, you know, in New York, which was also a wonderful space. And he's, you know, I, without any judgment, I think I can say he's not the easiest person to talk with, you know, and everyone knows publicly he tends to, you know, get argumentative and upset. And so, yeah, talking to him for as long as I did was fascinating, and yeah, it does relate to so many things. I suppose there's a lot of interconnection, which does speak to the art world. You know, in this whole series as a whole, I often talk to people who say, "My God, I know everybody you've interviewed, or I know, you know, most of the people you've interviewed," and I think I'm interviewing a lot of people that aren't well known. I'm trying to not just interview people like Cuspid and Lawrence Wiener and Andre Serrano. Majority of people are not nearly as well known as that, but the art world, in fact, is one thing that's come to mind to me. I'm talking to people all over the world, and it seems that it is still quite a small community where everybody tends to know a lot of the other people. There's not, we talk about the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of artists out there, but in terms of all the nonprofits and variety of people, there's only so many, and most people seem to know almost all of them.
That's amazing. So I suppose in closing this interview, you mentioned, I think, the Smithsonian was interested in your work. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there was somebody from their archive that just said, you know, someone told us about this and you were doing, but...
Yeah, without... you know, forcing them to back your project, but, you know, whether it's the Smithsonian or maybe the Getty Archives or something, imagine that somebody's listening to this precise interview in 250 years' time. Is there anything you'd like to tell that person?
They're listening to this in 250 years' time. Yeah, you know, I think I'd like to say to them, if you like what you're listening to, since I'm long gone, consider doing what this project is setting out to do, which is to have more conversations with more people. I mean, it's sort of infinitely scalable, right? You can just do this forever. There's lots of people to talk to, and it's of interest. It seems to the kind of community that I'm speaking to. So, you know, I mean, your interview or other people's interviews are interesting to other people who are listening to them. So for the people who may be listening in 250 years, I'd say, if there's still museums and all that's going on, interview people, you know, have a radio station. You know, now it's really, you know, like decades old or centuries old. And have public conversations because this is the fabric of life, isn't it? It's sort of who we are. I remember like a film teacher saying in college to the class, he said, you know, every now and then I get a film student who says to me, I wish people understood me for who I am instead of who I say I am. And he said, that's all we are is who we say we are and what we say. you may have wonderful things going on or interior conversations, but ultimately we are who we say we are. So, yeah, it's kind of a wonderfully odd question, Marco. So I would say, you know,
uncanny,
that kind of thing.
Well, I love that talk of the fabric of life. And I think with that, I think we're going to close the interview. And thanks so much for being with me and the other listeners.
Thank you for asking. It was really a lot of fun to talk with you, Marco.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.